believe that Bada may not happen in the definite science. This is the famous viewpoint among the Shia scholars. There is another viewpoint which claims that Bada may happen even in definite science.
We will discuss that in another session. If Bada can happen in definite science, the viewpoints. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, for being with us. I would want to tell you that we have had some texts from the Holland who were thanking you, were making notes from your lectures. Thank you so much for providing such an intellectual discussion here with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners, and you too. Keep on making notes, because this is the program that's going to provide you with the utmost information regarding the amount of your time. Thank you so much for listening to us. Thank you so much for being with us. Until another session, fi amanallah. God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Syria.
Part 1.
In Syria, I couldn't look the way I wanted to at the passing of 9 years, as I passed the streets, alleyways, and buildings. I could only keep myself composed to some extent, as opposed to many others who were in shock and awe when they encountered these scenes. Especially when I saw all of those factories and workshops that used to be full of workers, engineers, and technicians 9 years ago. People who are no longer in their workplaces. Many people who are no longer with us. There's not enough space in the ground to hide their bodies. Sometimes a park in the street becomes their burial place. I felt that in Syria, I didn't have the right to speak of anything other than the war for the past 9 years. However, I decided to at least look for answers to why all of this happened in Syria. Why Syria? In the United States, people are not very political. Therefore, it really doesn't matter to them what happens in the rest of the world.
So, thank you for your service and thank you what you do for this country. You know, we talk about sacrifice, we talk about all the things that soldiers do for this great country. And I'm always privileged to be here in this role and stand in front of a formation like this. And you put all of that aside. When our country calls and you answer the call and you go and serve our country in an incredible way and you make incredible sacrifices for the safety of this country. On a national level, we have these components of national power. A couple of them are diplomacy. Another one is economics. You hear people talk about, we're going to give this country a lot of money or we're going to withhold a lot of money from this country, all in the hopes that we can press forward with what we think as Oklahomans or Americans are important to our country. But every once in a while, diplomacy fails. You're a finite, small group of Americans that will say, I will take that charge, I will take that responsibility, I will raise my hand and go into harm's way for our country. And for that, we should all be grateful.
I'm sure most of the people watching this ceremony were asking themselves, which front line will they fight on to defend the United States? Where are these soldiers going? The answer is West Asia, somewhere in Jordan, specifically the Al Azraq Air Base. But this is not their final destination. They will actually be deployed to Tanf, which is a US military base in Syria. The arrival of so many forces and so much military hardware comes at a time when the US has officially announced that it intends to draw down its troops in Syria and then withdraw from the country, which is a bit strange. Even stranger is that the Americans have set up a base in the middle of the desert and have enlarged and equipped it to this extent within 2 years.
CBS News came to this place called Attaf with General Frank McKenzie, commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East.
David, we're standing on the Damascus-Baghdad highway just inside Syria, and what we're doing here is supporting our partners in the fight against ISIS.
However, not all the people here are American. Some members of Syria's opposition visit the Tanf base regularly. Apart from their looks and uniforms, they can be recognized by their Arabic language and their Toyota vans. It appears they are opposed to the Syrian government and have come together to fight the Syrian army. But it appears that their main mission after protecting the American base is controlling the roads that pass through Tanf. Of course, that's how they describe their mission. But the images of damaged trailers, trucks, suggests their main aim is disrupting the traffic on this trade route so that nothing passes through it, especially trucks carrying goods. The Americans have repeatedly threatened to destroy anything that enters the 50-kilometer radius of the base. What's strange is that this base is built exactly on a route which is the commercial and economic lifeline of Syria. Here, the roads used for transporting goods from the east to Syria. By east, I don't just mean Iraq and Iran. But I mean all countries to the east of Syria, including India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and most importantly, China. For centuries, the Chinese would use what's called the Silk Road to do trade with Europe and Africa. The Silk Road passes through Syria and leads to the Mediterranean Sea and the Black Sea. This way, people in the east could reach the ports of Europe and Africa in the Mediterranean for trade. In fact, compared to shipping by sea, the road can get our goods several times faster and cheaper to 22 countries with 100 ports. Nowadays, the Silk Road is not what it used to be in the past, and much of it is destroyed or replaced. Of course, the Chinese, in cooperation with many other Asian countries, like Iran, intend to revive the Silk Road. This is a decision which is not secret, as they have talked about it openly on many occasions. Till then, the road linking Baghdad to Damascus and from there to the Mediterranean coast is still considered as the Silk Road. Now, the Americans have established bases in Tanf, right on the main Baghdad-Damascus road, cutting off the Silk Road, and their allied militants don't even allow anyone to enter the base's 35-mile radius. For this reason, when the Iraqis who were in pursuit of ISIS forces entered Syria at the Syrian government's request and unknowingly approached this area, US warplanes would attack them.
Yeah, I want to go back to the Tanf operation that took place yesterday. Could you confirm that the targeted Shia militias were Iranians or Hezbollah? And do you see any interest, any vital interest to the U.S. and the coalition to control the whole Syrian-Iraqi border?
Let me take a stab at this. At Ad-Tanf is what you're referring to, the force that moved near Ad-Tanf. Is that what you're referring to? That was, again, as the chairman pointed out, self-defense of our forces. It was necessitated, sir, by offensive movement with offensive capability of what we believe were Iranian directed forces. I don't know there were Iranians on the ground.
The U.S. Secretary of Defense had claimed that the Iraqis were encouraged by Iran to make an offensive move. The Iraqis paid a price for the move: U.S. airstrikes. That meant getting close to Tanf was treated as an attack on U.S. forces. Thus, U.S. aircraft droplets over the area, warning against approaching the base. That's the reason why American troops came here from more than 9,500 kilometers away. These are the same heroes that were given a warm send-off ceremony by the American people to protect their dignity and interests, and have come here as if they are defending U.S. borders. Although, in some way, they were right. Tanf is where the U.S. defends its undisputed dominance over the West. A good thing about Trump is that we don't need to try hard to prove many of our claims about the U.S. anymore.
People
Iran's
want economic
place.
Freedom.
Iran's
so
a different place.
Is it true that
Iran's no longer thinking about the Mediterranean and going through and...
Trump mentions Iran because he knows many people among Syria's armed opposition rely on the U.S. to counter Iran's regional influence. But it's obvious what Trump means is cutting off eastern economies from the Mediterranean. All right, we said all this to show that the war in Syria is not just about ideology and religion. That's just one reason among many. But before we switch to another puzzle, this question comes to mind. When did they exactly decide to wage a war on Syria? Let's listen to what Wesley Clark has to say. During those years, Clark was the commander of US forces in NATO. He has also run for president several times.
I went through the Pentagon 10 days after 9/11. I couldn't stay away from Mother Army. I went back there to see Don Rumsfeld. I went downstairs. I was leaving the Pentagon, and an officer from the Joint Staff called me into his office and said, I want you to know, he said, sir, we're going to attack Iraq. And I said, why? He said, we don't know. He said, I said, well, did they tie Saddam to 9/11? He said, no. He said, but I guess it's they don't know what to do about terrorism. And so they think, but they can attack states, and they want to look strong. And so I walked out of there pretty upset. And then we attacked Afghanistan. I was pretty happy about that. We should have. And then I came back to the Pentagon about 6 weeks later. I saw the same officer. I said, why haven't we attacked Iraq? We still going to attack Iraq? He said, oh, sir. He says, it's worse than that. He said, he pulled up a piece of paper off his desk. He said, I just got this memo from the Secretary of Defense's office. It says we're going to attack and destroy the governments in seven countries in 5 years. We're going to start with Iraq, and then we're going to move to Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Iran. I said, seven countries in 5 years. I said, is that a classified memo? He said, yes, sir. I said, well, don't show it to me. He was about to show it to me. He said, because I want to talk about it.
Wesley Clark is not the only person who believes the war in Syria was planned long before it started. Many others, like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., also share this belief. He is the nephew of the former President of the United States. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is both a lawyer and author, published an article in 2016 in Politico magazine entitled, Why Arabs Don't Want Us in Syria. The article stunned many. He writes, in their view, our war against Bashar Assad did not begin with the peaceful civil protests of the Arab Spring in 2011. Instead, it began in 2000, when Qatar proposed to construct a $10 billion, 1,500-kilometer pipeline through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and Turkey. To see whether Kennedy's claims are true or false, we go back to the year 2000. As you are aware, Russia is the biggest producer and exporter of natural gas, with Europe being its biggest customer. The Russians export 70% of their produced natural gas to Europe. This means a steady source of income for the Russians. Russia has been using this as a tool to put pressure on Europe. For example, when European countries in 2009 sided with Ukraine in its price dispute with Russia's gas company Gazprom, the Russians turned off the gas taps in response. All this shows that the Europeans would want to disentangle themselves from this predicament, and the United States would also love to see such a huge source of revenue from its rival Russia. The US is highly motivated as it tries to find an alternative to Russia's gas. As a result, they have turned to Qatar and Azerbaijan for gas. But the fact is that Europe's demand for gas could not be met via sea only, and that such a huge supply could only be sent to the continent through a pipeline. This was where the notion of the Qatari gas pipeline was put forth. That's the same energy transit route that would pass through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Syria, and then reach Europe via Turkish terminals. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. writes, "In Putin's view, the Qatar pipeline is a NATO plot to change the status quo, deprive Russia of its only foothold in the Middle East, strangle the Russian economy, and end Russian leverage in the European energy market."
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. Stay tuned. Unfortunately, most people are like a mirage. They seem to be water, but they are not. In a beautiful hadith we read, a believer is like the water. This means that his actions and words are the same, and he is sincere in his deeds. As Imam Ali alayhi salam also stated, Allah created sincerity in the nature of humans and made them the best among his creatures. If we act clearly and like water, then we are not worried about the judgments of others. We in this world are captivated by the looks and opinions of others. All our pretentious formalities and looks are because we live according to the standards of others. Therefore, we can't grow in our lives and we are disconnected from others. However, if we act like flowers, we keep our beauty everywhere, whether in a garden, in a desert, or in a ways.
Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Olema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojjatul Islam Ranjbah. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Inflation is continuing to rise in America and prices move faster than increases in salaries of employees and workers. Problems in the supply chain, the war in Ukraine and high demand for consumers have kept the prices of goods in the United States at their highest level in the past 40 years. In a report, CNN says that inflation is rampant in the United States, and the central bank's tool to fight price increases is to set higher interest rates. This makes borrowing more expensive and slows down the US economy. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The New York Post has covered this story. An analysis from the Heritage Foundation showed the average American has lost $4,200 in annual income since President Joe Biden took office. Experts at the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, say in a recent report, the losses come down to surging inflation and higher interest rates. Their analysis found that the average American has lost about $3,000 in annual purchasing power because consumer prices, which have risen 12.7% since January of 2021, have spiked significantly faster than wages. Wages have risen just 8% over the same period, which has effectively resulted in a pay cut for Americans struggling to pay for daily necessities, including food, gas, and rent. Higher interest rates and borrowing costs have also reduced the average person's purchasing power by another $1,200. E.J. Anthony, a research fellow in regional economics with the Heritage Foundation Center for Data Analysis, says, "Simply put, working Americans are $4,200 poorer today than they were when Joe Biden took office." E.J. Anthony added, "This financial catastrophe for American families is a direct result of a president and Congress addicted to spending our money, combined with a Federal Reserve compliantly enabling this addiction by printing more dollars." He added, "Now, the U.S. Federal Reserve is finally fighting inflation, which is pushing up interest rates and increasing financing costs. Rates on all kinds of consumer debt are rising. Mortgage interest rates have doubled since Joe Biden took office, greatly increasing Americans' monthly payments. Concerns about persistent inflation were renewed recently when federal data showed consumer prices had increased 8.3% in the month of August, compared to the same month 1 year earlier, a figure that was worse than what economists had been expecting. The British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. US Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell warned recently that there would be pain ahead as the US central bank struggles to contain a surge in inflation unseen in the past 40 years. US Federal Reserve announced another sharp rise in interest rates on Wednesday afternoon, 21st of September, after the conclusion of its meeting. It also updated its economic forecast for the US economy. Economists say the Federal Reserve raised its benchmark interest rate by 0.75 percentage points, the third such rise in a row, and plans to raise interest rates again in the coming months. The hike comes as central banks around the world are increasing rates to tackle a soaring cost of living crisis. Last year, the US Federal Reserve dismissed inflation as a transitory issue, triggered by the pandemic and supply chain issues. But consumer prices have remained stubbornly high and have remained so despite a change in the US Federal Reserve's view and its aggressive interest rate rises. The Bureau of Labor Statistics announced recently that prices were 8.3% higher last month compared with August of last year. The US Federal Reserve's target rate for inflation is 2% annually. That news has led some to speculate that the US Federal Reserve could increase interest rates by a full percentage point, a drastic move for an institution that usually moves rates cautiously up and down by just a quarter of a percentage point. The sharp rise in interest rates are aimed at slowing the economy and bringing down prices. Higher interest rates have fed through to the housing market, where rates for a 30-year mortgage have now passed the 6% mark for the first time in the past 14 years. Until recently, Jerome Powell had suggested a soft landing was possible for the economy, in which rising interest rates would bring down prices without causing a severe financial downturn. But at the annual meeting of the central bankers in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, last month, Jerome Powell acknowledged that economic distress was a price that the Federal Reserve was willing to pay to control inflation. He said, "While higher interest rates, slower growth, and softer labor market conditions will bring down inflation, they will also bring some pain to households and businesses. These are the unfortunate costs of reducing inflation, but a failure to restore price stability would mean far greater pain." We'll be right back. The U.S. newspaper The Hill has covered the same story. U.S. markets are bottoming out as they process the latest interest rate hikes from the U.S. Federal Reserve in its battle to fight 40-year high inflation. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 500 points to hit 29,590 at market close on Friday, 24th of September, its lowest point in nearly 2 years. Since the U.S. Federal Reserve started raising interest rates in March, the index has lost more than 13% of its value and is down more than 19% on the year. Other indices have followed suit. The Standard & Poor's 500 index fell 65 points to close at 3,693 on Friday, down more than 15% since last March and almost 23% on the year. The technology-heavy Nasdaq dropped nearly 200 points or 1.8% of its value to close at 10,867, down almost 20% since last March. Interest rates have increased to 3.25% since the U.S. Federal Reserve started raising them from 0% back in March. This has had the effect of making many goods and services more expensive and driving down demand to bring down inflation.
Why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islami dini wal-Azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Are going to talk about some of the Islamic laws about medical issues and conditions according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography and we'll be back. Don't go away.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javed, since we are talking about some of the Islamic laws related to the medical issues according to Ayatollah Khamenei, let me ask you this question. If a boy and a girl, God forbid, had a legal physical relationship resulting in the girl becoming pregnant with an illegitimate child, all right?
Yes.
In this event, that later they marry each other legally, of course, is the child considered legitimate or illegitimate?
The marriage contract concluded after fornication or adultery, of course, God forbid, does not change what happened previously.
Mm-hmm. Or prior to the marriage.
Yeah, prior to the marriage, you're right. Therefore, if a girl, let's say, conceives before the legal marriage contract, the child is illegitimate by birth, and therefore all the consequences should be understood in that context, that the child is illegitimate.
Would you give some examples of those consequences?
Yeah, of course, the consequences that the child, an illegitimate child, cannot inherit, he does not inherit, she does not inherit, and of course, as a legitimate person who by birth was born illegitimate,
mm-hmm.
cannot lead a congregational prayer, he cannot become a judge, a Muslim judge. And these are some of the consequences of you know, illegitimacy of birth.
Yes.
Illegitimacy of birth. So no matter what is going to happen after fornication, whether the boy and girl marries each other or not, or they do not marry, in either case, in both cases, of course, the child will not become legitimate by birth.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, thank you very much. You know, my next question, Sheikh Javed, is that some hereditary diseases, such as thalassemia and sickle cell anemia, spread in our society very much, spread like wildfire, which have negative effects on children. And some of them are very dangerous, perilous. If a man marries a woman who conceives and then comes to know that the fetus suffers from any of or one of these diseases, is it then permissible or is it good enough reason to abort the pregnancy?
Just as I said in one of the previous answers to your question, I think it's not actually it's not my answer. It is the answer coming from
the Risala or the Manual of Islamic Laws authored by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, it's not permissible to have abortion under any circumstances, like the example you gave. For example, a child suffers from a disease and that disease might spread, okay, or maybe the child might be born with a disease, okay, the disease, every child might, you know, have some kind of health issues or health conditions, and these health conditions do not become a license for termination of the pregnancy. And therefore, a man, you know, or a woman should not, let's say, under these excuses, go ahead having abortion. And it's very much prudent, very much important that the man and the woman should, you know, go for premarital screening or the medical tests that are now carried out in order to reduce the possibility of such diseases, you know, and therefore it's very much important that the man chooses a woman who to marry after careful examination, and to ensure the safety, the safety of his offspring, and to ensure that he will, of course, have children, healthy children.
Mm-hmm.
That these precautionary measures should be taken, of course. And if it's not taken, if there is a child that's going to be born with a disease, or maybe it's likely to, the child is likely to be born with a disease, these excuses or these causes, these reasons cannot be an excuse, a valid excuse, or an acceptable excuse for termination of the pregnancy.
I see. Thank you very much, Dr. Abid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go anywhere. For this program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. We are still talking about some of the Islamic laws related to the medical issues with Sheikh Javid. You, you know, kindly answered lots of questions that I raised regarding the medical issues. I would like to ask you another question, Sheikh Javid, and I would be delighted if I have your comment on this. What is the ruling on using contraceptives such as tablets, injections, coils, insulation, suppositories, cervical caps, ointments, and the like?
Good. You know, we have already answered this question, but now you're giving me some very good examples, like, you know, injections, you know, cervical caps and so on.
Yes.
These are the contraceptives methods used nowadays. They are very much current. Of course, all of them are allowed if they do not lead to the termination of the sperm after it has been, you know, conceived, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If, for example, a woman is already pregnant and the woman takes the tablet to kill the, you know, there are such in scenarios. A woman feels, okay, very strongly that she is very much likely to be pregnant. And then she jumps into action and takes, you know, a tablet or does something to terminate the pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
Even though she's not sure, but in the event that she has a strong feeling that she is pregnant, she cannot use these contraceptives, which somehow prove to be fatal and to be deadly, and which might cause the death of the fetus.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to make sure that she is not pregnant, otherwise she cannot use any of these contraceptives. Of course, some of these contraceptive methods are not deadly. they can be used.
Mm-hmm. I see. Quite related to what you try to imply in the answer to the previous question that I raised and I asked you, what is the ruling on using contraceptives when one does not know how those contraceptives work and effect?
Generally speaking, contraceptives are allowed, and when one does not know, when a woman does not know that she is pregnant or that she has conceived, she can use all of those contraceptives, provided, you know, we discussed it in one of the episodes, that the contraceptives must not terminate, must not cause permanent, destruction of the uterus, or it should not be irreversible. Of course, if it is reversible, there's no objection. Otherwise, it is problematic.
Mm-hmm. And, Shashavit, as the last question, I would like to ask you about a birth control method. Is it permissible for a woman to perform a procedure called tubal ligation as a birth control method with the husband's consent?
Well, as long as the husband is consenting to it, it is permissible. And as I said, if it is a reversible contraceptive method, which means that returning to the normal state is possible at any stage, and whenever the woman actually wants to return, then there is no objection in it. It is permissible. The husband's consent is required. But of course, when just change the scenario and go the other way around, like for example, if the husband wants to use vasectomy, he does not need his wife's consent and permission. But if it's the other way around, of course, the wife should take her husband's consent and permission. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there is objection.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice answers. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Mala ilaha illa hum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basir La ilaha illa hum Wahidun Qadirun Muhyin Mumitun Al-Zahir Wal-Batin La ilaha illa hu La ilaha illa hu
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says those responsible for Wednesday's deadly terrorist attack on an Iranian shrine